Hello and welcome aboard Seascapes, your maritime programme. On this week's edition, we'll be hearing about next weekend's Irish Sailing Association National Conference, where the support team of the ISA Olympic programme, physio Mark McCabe and psychologist Kate Kirby, will be sharing their secrets for physical and mental readiness for the season ahead for free for all ISA members. And Olympic sailor Matt McGovern will talk about the highs and lows of London 2012 and how they've prepared him for his Rio 2016 campaign. We mark the passing of Eileen Cleary from Ventry, who witnessed the rescue of Greek sailors aboard the Diamantis by a German U-boat U-35. Plus, Al Sisk with another gem on yachting history. First, this week to our Galway studios, where features editor Gerry Flynn has all the gen on what's in the latest edition of Inshore Ireland magazine.
BIM's contentious proposal for a large-scale salmon farm in Galway Bay is scrutinised over 5 pages in February's Inshore Ireland. Beneath the front page headline, "Sea Lice Not a Significant Factor in the Decline of Wild Salmon," we report that a research team at the Marine Institute has ruled out this tiny parasite as the main culprit for the alarmingly high mortality of wild salmon at sea, saying that the real cause is more likely to be due to a complex combination of factors such as global warming, changes in the availability or location of the salmon's natural prey species, increased fishing pressure and predation, and the loss of young salmon to bycatch. Dr. David Jackson, head of the National Sea Lice Monitoring Program at the Marine Institute, stands by his team's finding, saying that a recent analysis of 9 years' worth of data suggests that sea lice account for only 1% of the overall mortality of salmon at sea and are in fact only a minor and irregular component, unlikely to be a significant factor influencing the conservation of salmon stocks. Inland Fisheries Ireland, however, another state agency whose mandate includes the management of sea angling resources, challenges the significance of this finding, arguing that even a mortality as low as 1%, directly attributable to sea lice, could be the tipping point between having an open or closed fishery. And while supporting the development of what it calls a sustainable aquaculture industry, the IFI says it welcomes all advances in research that will underpin the sustainability of the fish farming industry and safeguard wild salmon and sea trout stocks into the future. The angler's view emerges on page 14, where Noel Carr of the Federation of Irish Salmon and Sea Trout Anglers, FISTA, dismisses Minister Coveney's new strategy for deep water salmon farms, declaring it to be the final nail in the coffin of what was a sustainable resource that could now be wiped out within a few seasons. Turning to commercial sea fisheries, an article by Gillian Mills on page 4 quotes Minister Coveney saying that the January agreement, which allocates 90% of the €1 billion worth mackerel fishery to the EU and Norway, is a continuation of the normal sharing arrangement which both parties have applied in recent years, which, according to the minister, did not reward Iceland or the Faroe Islands with any larger share of the stock, despite their demands. This article includes a reaction to the agreement from Iceland's Minister of Industry and Innovation, Steingrimur Sigfusson, saying it was disappointing that the EU and Norway have claimed 90% of the catch, leaving only 10% for Iceland, the Faroe Islands and Russia. Other stories in this packed issue include Ron Beamster's doubts that fracking will deliver the jobs its advocates promise, while our angling correspondent Brendan Connolly declares that 2012 was a bumper year for specimen fish, and we have the pictures to prove it, including one of Colin Gardiner and Timothy Dalton proudly displaying their joint first salmon of 2013, caught on the Drowse fishery. On page 16, we have a map of the proposed survey areas for the Infomar programme through 2013, now under the direction of the GSI's new director, Dr. Cúan Verbruggen. And finally, following the recent deaths of broadcaster Eamon de Buettler and IFI fisheries biologist Trevor Champ, we include warm tributes to both men whose lifetime's work has contributed hugely to our knowledge and appreciation of Ireland's aquatic environment, freshwater and marine. All this and more in February's Inshore Ireland.
Gerry Flynn of Inshore Ireland magazine Try not to miss the final episode in the current run of Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall's Fish Fight Save Our Seas on Channel 4 Television. Do you have a view on the state of our fisheries? Are, as some people are asking, the days of our entire fishing fleet around our coast numbered? Drop Seascapes a line to Seascapes, RTE Radio 1, Father Matthew Street in Cork, or email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. At the ISA conference on Saturday next, the 2nd of March, the support team of the ISA Olympic programme will be sharing their secrets for physical and mental readiness for the season ahead for free for all ISA members. ISA Olympic team physio Mark McCabe will deliver what's described as a no-nonsense workshop on strength and conditioning, and ISA team psychologist Kate Kirby will discuss how mental factors can influence performance. Also not to be missed, Olympic 49er sailor Matt McGovern will talk about the highs and lows of London 2012 and how it prepared him for his Rio 2016 campaign. Starting from 11:15 in the morning in the Royal Marine Hotel in Dúnlaoghaire, this seminar will prepare all competitive sailors for the season ahead. Don't forget, that's next Saturday, the 2nd of March. You can reserve your place for free on www.sailing.ie. Next here on Seascapes to yachting historian Hal Sisk, author of Dublin Bay, the Cradle of Yacht Racing, and his thoughts on the early history of this pursuit.
400 years ago, it started in Holland. And 250 years ago, it was practiced in Cork. There was also an incident where King Charles II in 1660, when he came back to the throne, had a yacht and a number of royal yachts built. And then eventually, in 1815, the English started with their what was to become the Royal Yacht Squadron, significantly after the Battle of Trafalgar. So Britain had won the war against France. It was now safe to go to sea without threat of privateers. There's a very important watershed in all of this. In the earlier periods, in Holland, in England, in Cork, yachts were not really vessels to be used for leisure as we know today. For most of the time, they were simply 17th and 18th century equivalents of a big limo or an executive jet. It was safer, smoother, sometimes faster, and certainly more stylish to travel in one of these from your country estate to the city and back for wealthy landowners than it was to be bounced around on the rutted, unpaved roads on a carriage, staying at perhaps overcrowded inns. And therefore, yachts were functional vessels for most of the time. This continued right up until the railway age. In the first part of the 19th century, even in that English tradition, that was still the primary function. What is interesting is that in Holland, in Cork, there was no racing. All they engaged in were mock battles. This is where they went out, maybe only one day in a month, and sailed back and forth in squadrons as if they were fighting a battle. Racing only came in very gradually in the early 19th century, and then eventually with the in the railway age, when the earlier function of yachts was now redundant. Only then, and with the development of the middle class and the amateur concept, the Corinthian concept as they called it, only then did what we would now recognise as sailing emerge, where people actually sailed their own vessels. Sailing your own boat was not a feature of any of the earlier yachting. In fact, to paraphrase Captain Kirk, it was yachting, but not as we know it. There were different sizes of vessels, but remember, there was no racing. So we didn't really have that in the way we would have today. The Dutch had two types of yachts. They had small inshore vessels in their delta, watery delta. They had speeljacht, which means a vessel used for pleasure, for sailing. And then they had a larger one called a statenjacht, which was a really luxurious big, that's the executive jet type I mentioned, and that's the one that King Charles got a present of. The Cork yachts were something in between the two, but they were still very much in the Dutch tradition. How they sailed and how they used them was still very much as the Dutch did. For example, in 1697, when Peter the Great visited Holland, they organised a similar mock battle in Amsterdam for him. So that's the tradition that they had, but it's not what we have now. My friend Michael Clark up in Enniskillen has identified that up in Loch Earn, there was a very active inshore lake sailing racing fleet in the 1820s. And in 1826, one of them was advertised as a Danzig. We know that in Dublin, around the same time, there were three classes of yachts. The largest were wherries, which were about 50-foot clinker schooners. The second type were kinsale hookers, similar to today's Galway hookers, only somewhat larger. And the third type was an amazing Danzig. Now, why did they call them that? Because they imported them, fully built, from what was then the East Prussian port of Danzig. It's now the Polish city of Gdansk. These vessels were brought in and modified by the Dublin yachtsmen, and they even spread to Loch Earn. And there's another funny twist. The oldest sailing trophy in the world is not the America's Cup, as the Americans would like us to believe. The oldest sailing trophy that we have in Ireland is a trophy which is in the Sligo County Museum. And it's inscribed with the legend, "Presented by the ladies of the county to promote fast sailing on Loch Gill." So it shows that right up there in the northwest, they had competitive sailing as early as the 1820s.
Hal Sisk, author of Dublin Bay, the Cradle of Yacht Racing, and that perspective on the history of the sport. Galway Bay Sailing Club were in touch about a series of spring talks in their clubhouse over the coming weeks, and the talks are free and start at 8:30 in the evening. On next Wednesday, the 27th of February, the crew of the Round Ireland campaign from NUI Galway will relate their story. And on the 6th of March, Nick Katz tells of his experience sailing from Clifton to Greenland and back. Those talks in Galway Bay Sailing Club start at 8:30 at the clubhouse, and directions to the club are generally to follow the signs for the Marine Institute near Oran Mór outside the city. On the 3rd of October in 1939, the German U-boat U-35, captained by Werner Lott, sank the Greek merchant vessel, the Diamantis, off the coast of Cornwall. The U-boat captain rescued all 28 Greek crewmen from the wreck and made the voyage for neutral shores to Ventry. The story of this rescue made the front cover of Time and Life magazines. We visit the Seascapes archive as just last week we learnt of the passing of Eileen Cleary, who witnessed the arrival of the Greek sailors on the morning of the 4th of October in 1939 when she was a young girl. The Ventry Historical Society marked the event in October of 2009 with a special ceremony attended by the mayor of the UNIC Islands, descendants of the crew of the Diamantis, and the German ambassador to Ireland at the time, Dr. Busso von Abendsleiten.
I was deeply touched indeed, first of all by the initiative coming from the Ventry Historical Society to commemorate this event, which also in the context of the Second World War was, of course, perhaps not unique, but outstanding. There's absolutely no doubt about it. And I think it's a great signal to have these friends from Greece over here, descendants of crew members and relatives and the mayor of Venusis.
I would like to remind you of the magnanimous, as the ambassador said, stance of Captain Werner Lott, the commander of the submarine, who notified the captain of the Greek vessel Diamantis, Captain Panagos Pateras, who is a distant relative of mine. The people were very wet when they went on board the submarine. The crew gave them cigarettes, dried their clothes, they gave them good food, hot food, and brought them here, and they landed. So thank you all. Thank you for the great honor of this lovely monument, austere, very laconic, beautiful, like the Celtic people monument. Let this incident not happen again, and we are all united in a united Europe, and this incident brings the people of Inusse, of Ventry, of Greece, of Ireland, Germany, and Britain as well, people who were on different sides of the war, we are all united, one peoples, and let's live in peace. Thank you very much.
Mayor of Unises, Evangelos Angelakos. The last surviving eyewitness, Eileen Cleary, as a child, saw the Greek seamen arrive.
They were tired and weary. Wouldn't you be tired and weary if you were inside the boat, perish with the cold? And they're half naked and no clothes and no shoes and when they are wet. And they're shivering with the cold, the creatures, and starved with hunger. I tell you, we would be starving too, and we would be cold. And they came over through the fields and they were brought over and brought down into, came into our yard. And they went in, another neighbour of mine, called Owen Cleary. His name is Owen, he'd be Eugene Cleary. And he took him from our house and he brought him down across the field to his own house, where they had some food ready to give them, because they were just staggering with hunger and cold. And I think they got a lot of food down in Cleary's. There was old Mrs. Cleary, she's all dead now, and her son and her daughter. They looked after them very, very, there was 28 of them there, and they fed every one of the 28.
And of course they had to find a doctor, I presume, to take her.
They had to find a doctor, Dr. Paddy Moriarty. He lived in Dingle for years, a very great old doctor. He was always attached to the Dingle Hospital. Some of them were taken to the hospital because they were very exhausted with the cold. I don't know what they gave them. They gave them something and even some boots. They kept them, I think, for a few days. And then they picked themselves up anyway and they all went off home together. But I think they all ended very happy. None of them died. And we looked after them very well around here when they came into our land. And they had a lot of climbing to do by the time they got from the sea up onto a rock and then up to another rock and up into the fields. It was very, very special this day to be here. And I'm very glad that I was here amongst the special ones today. Because I was the eldest, I was the only one here who knew that had seen him. I was the only one who sees him.
Now, we have something very special for you now. Our local piper, Owen Dignan, will not only play some music on his pipes, but he actually has composed a special piece of music for this occasion.
John D. Pateras, a grandson of the master of the Diamantis, also attended the ceremony.
I have heard the stories from my grandmother. She passed away just a few years ago. We were discussing that. But coming here and actually living, seeing all the place where all this happened has been very emotional for me. It has made me realize how this has changed my life tremendously, but also a few things of the history of our island and even in our country, as my grandfather's family grew up to do a few things through their enterprises for the country as well back then. So leaving all that and realizing is a totally different thing that rather than something that we were discussing many miles away and could never have the right impression of the magnitude of what happened those 2 days 70 years ago.
Well, I thought it was very, very special to celebrate what could have been a very tragic occasion and turn it into something really momentous where men went above and beyond the call of duty to rescue the Greek sailors. So it was a wonderful celebration of mankind's goodness.
Yeah, I'm German and I'm coming from East Prussia, and I had to escape before the Russian came in. And so that is now another story. But I'm so happy that here and now in Ventry, where we are, you know, living, it's wonderful.
And it was such a huge news story at the time. It was on the front page of Life magazine. And I suppose it was in the very, very early days of the war.
That's right. Well, again, it's now part of the folklore of Kerry. Cabin gwil sé untuk in yov, gwil Tommy John Shahi Lahar, Bela just bio in yov, agus gamai an lak shin an anishtar gar foshti a mahansha, agus maradouch an tambassador on yaramon, tashi untuk mar kujden gwilimuj galer gerla shikhan tashaik turchne nashun galer lihela, agus le kunuje niveg.
I'm a local of Ventry now, but I'm German. I came here when I was 15, and I'm very happy that the three nationalities today celebrated something, and we were all addressed in our own language, which I really like, by Brendan O'Kivan, who set this up, and I was really proud to be part of it and see all my neighbours, my German neighbours, my Irish neighbours, my Greek friends. It was really nice. Unified us here in Ventry as a local community, and get upon all little things we maybe have between each other, but there we were together and had a beautiful afternoon because there was a courageous man who made a decision which was maybe not very popular at the time, but for now it gave us a lot, and I hope a lot of school children will go into the exhibition because I saw it yesterday, it's worthwhile going, and I hope the teachers will go and the teachers of Dingle will take the pupils and show them what happened. It's living history, you see, that's what I like about it.
My soul has been torn from me, and I am bleeding. My heart, it has been rent, and I am crying. All the beauty around me fades. Last night I heard the cry of my last.
Last of the Great Whales, also known as the Leviathan. We dedicate that piece with the remarkable voice of Sean Cannon of the Dubliners to the tenor with Fisherman's Friends Trevor Grills of Port Isaac and the band's tour manager Paul McMullen, who lost their lives following a recent accident at the G Live concert venue in Guildford, where Fisherman's Friends had been scheduled to perform. The Royal St George Yacht Club is hosting a dinghy sailing seminar this Saturday, the 23rd, which is open to all senior Dunlera dinghy sailors. You can hear from speakers Noel Butler, James Espy and Graham Elms from 10:30 in the Royal St George Yacht Club's junior room. Next Friday night on Seascapes, where the land meets the sea, with author Anna Ryan from the School of Architecture at the University of Limerick, Dick Robinson and the tale of a close call at Bag and Bun Head off Dunmore East, Irish seabirds and the latest edition of Wings from Birdwatch Ireland. All this and much more. So until next Friday night here on Seascapes, tight lines and fair sailing.